Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Roughly 300,000 patients in the United States get surgical site infections every year, and a new University of Utah study suggests that some of those infections are connected to a heritable genetic mutation. In the February 19, 2013, online edition of the journal Wound Repair and Regeneration, researchers from the University School of Medicine show through a study of families in the Utah population database that surgical site infections, SSIs, appear to have a significant genetic connection, even in extended relatives. Dr. Harriet Hoff, professor of anesthesiology at the University of Utah School of Medicine, co-author on the article, joins us to talk about the study. First, she describes the impact of the problem.
It's a little bit of a hard number to pin down exactly, but surgical site infections happen about 5% of operations overall. They're a huge problem that costs billions of dollars every year. They often make people either stay longer in the hospital or more often come back to the hospital because they usually show up somewhere between 4 and 7 days after surgery, sometimes as long as a month after surgery, and most patients are out of the hospital in a couple of days. So usually they happen at home, so they can mean readmission to the hospital. Sometimes they require one or more reoperations. In the example of, for example, hip replacement surgery, very few people get an infection, but if you get an infection, they often have to remove the hardware they put in, and it can take a year to kind of get yourself back to really being able to walk well and getting rid of the infection and getting the new hip replacement device in. So they cause a lot of cost. They keep people from going back to work. It's very hard to go back to work if you're doing dressing changes on an open wound. When someone gets a surgical site infection, normally what happens is you open the wound to drain the bacteria and then you let it close itself. Sometimes you'll go back in a few days and close it again. So it's a huge problem in the United States. And in fact, as evidence of how big a problem it is, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, which oversees health care for patients with Medicare and Medicaid, but they tend to drive policy, has something called the Surgical Care Improvement Project, or SCIP. And there's a number of measures that they ask hospitals to do things right to make sure they try to prevent them. And a surprising number of those Surgical Care Improvement Project process interventions are related to preventing surgical site infection. So we measure, for example, are we keeping our patients warm? Do we give them antibiotics of the right kind and at the right time before their surgery? And there are whole guidelines on how to prevent surgical site infection, and we actually have a perioperative infection control committee, which we call Bug Busters, here at the University of Utah, which I co-chair with Kathy Adamson, who's one of our nurse administrators. And we meet, and our goal is to prevent surgical site infections. We have a two-page document that sort of says, here's all the things you need to do as an anesthesiologist, as a nurse, as a surgeon, to make sure your patient doesn't get an infection. You need to wash your hands, and you need to wear a hat and special clothes, and you need to keep your surface areas clean and give the antibiotics at the right time. So there's huge effort put into surgical site infection prevention.
It is important to take a step back here and find out what inspired Hoff to conduct this research. She grew up in New Hampshire.
I went to medical school at Dartmouth in my home state, and then I did actually a surgery internship at the University of Minnesota. At the end of my internship, I went out to University of California, San Francisco, to do a year of research with a surgeon there named Tom Hunt, who's was the founding president of the Wound Healing Society. We were interested in measuring oxygen in wounds, and that's what I learned how to do when I was there. And while I was there, I had a change of heart and decided I wanted to become an anesthesiologist, and I actually stayed at UCSF for 19 years and did my anesthesia residency there and then stayed on the faculty. And throughout my time there, I actually spent much of my time measuring oxygen in wounds and continuing to collaborate with Tom Hunt. When I arrived in the lab, we knew that there were a lot of wounds that had low oxygen levels and that raising them might make a difference. And it turns out anesthesiologists are the perfect people to manage how much blood is getting to people's wounds and whether they're getting enough oxygen during surgery. So that's how I kind of tied together being an anesthesiologist who studies surgical site infection.
And then can you describe how you actually manage that? Is it through oxygen levels, or how do you control that? How much oxygen?
The big thing that makes wounds in general, have less oxygen than they need, or is that you get constriction of the blood vessels in the wounds. And usually that's in response. Part of that is you, when you make a wound, you cut some of the blood vessels, so that causes a little bit of a problem. But a big part of it is the sympathetic nervous system, or the fight-or-flight response, which is or adrenaline. And adrenaline causes blood vessel constriction, particularly in the skin, with the idea that your heart and brain need more blood in an emergency than your skin does. But it turns out when there's a wound, it doesn't help it very much. And the things that set off the sympathetic nervous system fight-or-flight response are, generally speaking, major things that cause it: pain, being cold, being stressed or anxious, and being dehydrated. And if you think about patients having surgery, you're wearing nothing, so you're cold. The operating room is kept cold because the surgeons get too warm when they're operating. Surgery is often painful. Patients are not supposed to eat or drink anything the night before surgery, and then they can bleed, so being dehydrated is common. And most patients coming to the operating room are feeling very stressed. So the person who's in charge of all those things is actually the anesthesiologist. We give people anxiety-relieving medications. We give them fluids. We give them pain relief, and we have the opportunity of keeping them warm. So one of the first big studies we did showed that when you keep patients who are having colon surgery warm, instead of allowing them to get cold in that cold environment, which is a side effect of anesthesia, you can actually reduce their rate of surgical site infection by about two-thirds. That was a big change. So we now keep patients warm in the operating room as a routine. It turns out that keeping them warm actually raises the amount of oxygen that gets to their wound. Now, once you have a patient who doesn't have a lot of fight or flight response and is well perfused and good blood flow to their skin, if you give them extra oxygen, you can reduce their risk of infection as well. That's because the white cells use oxygen to kill bacteria, so it's part of host defense. But if you have someone who's cold and vasoconstricted, you can give them more oxygen, but it doesn't get there. So yes, giving oxygen can improve wound healing, or wound healing and resistance to infection, but only when you've taken care of the other stuff.
Oh, that's so interesting. And are there, what types of surgeries tend to lead to more infections? Or are there certain types that cause more infections than others?
There are. And there's sort of two factors that we think about. One is the wound getting contaminated? So that's why when you think about surgery, you think about the surgeons wear gowns and gloves and hats, and they wash their hands, and they wash the patient's skin, and they put drapes on. So they try to reduce the number of bacteria that are in the patient's wound. We also give antibiotics before surgery. And the other side is host defense. How well can your white cells kill bacteria? And it turns out both of them are very important. And I've been very, very interested in the host defense side of things. So the host defense side of things is really important, but when you think about wounds that tend to get infections, wounds that are contaminated, so wounds in the abdominal cavity, particularly wounds on the colon, because we know there are bacteria there to begin with, have a much higher rate of infection than, say, hip surgery. So when you're having colon surgery, the expected rate of infection is somewhere between 10 and 15% of patients will get a wound infection. If you're having hip replacement surgery or knee replacement surgery, the expected rate of infection is 1 to 2%.
Wow.
So clearly there's a big difference in that contamination level. At the same time, host defenses are important. We know that, for example, if you operate on a patient who's got diabetes, they have less good host defenses. Their white cells don't work as well, and they also often have decreased blood flow, particularly on their legs. They have a much higher risk of infection. On the other hand, when you operate on someone's face, they almost never get infected because there's such a great blood supply there. And the classic example of this is actually hemorrhoid surgery. So lots of people have hemorrhoids removed. It's hard to imagine a place more contaminated in the body than the rectum and where you're getting your hemorrhoids fixed. And those essentially never get infected because they have a huge blood supply. There's sort of those two factors: how much contamination is there and how good is the blood supply? And there's an interaction between the two, so that if you don't have a very good blood supply, you don't need very much contamination. If you've got a great blood supply, you can tolerate a lot of contamination. I think colon surgery is more contamination and pretty good blood supply, but not great blood supply, and that's why it's one of our favorite models, because it's got among the higher infection rates.
And then could you talk about your recent study and the gene that you suspect is associated with people who tend to get surgical site infections more than others, and there tends to be a correlation between relatedness?
Sure. So we actually don't know what gene it's related to. This is really a study that says, is there some genetic contribution? So when I got to the University of Utah 6.5 years ago, it seemed to me that given all I knew about host defenses, and there's been some studies that, for example, some people have a genetic susceptibility to getting a blood infection, getting sepsis, you know, and so that suggested to me that there are probably people who have susceptibility to getting a wound infection, and I could imagine which genes I think might be implicated, but I don't really know which ones they are. So I'd been thinking about this question for a while, and I came to the University of Utah, and I had a medical student, James Lee, who's the first author, who came to my office when he was a first-year medical student and said, I'd really like to do research with you. And I said, well, here's a problem I've been trying to address, and I know we have this Utah population database, but I don't know how to get in there. I'd like to know, are there some patients who are more likely to get infections than others based on their genetics? And he said, hey, well, I know Lisa Cannon Albright, and she's amazing, and she's got the Utah population database. I think we should collaborate with her. So he actually facilitated my talking to Lisa. And I don't. So the Utah population database is it's a database with 2 million people from a genealogical database from the LDS Church that was accessed in the 1970s that has great information in it, plus about somewhere between 5 and 7 million other records of people from Utah where there is less perfect genetic genealogical data, but where they're related to some people. So it gives you the opportunity to ask questions like, are there families that are more likely to have, for example, rotator cuff tears? And that was a study done by Robert Tashin and Lisa Cannon Albright a few years ago, and they showed that indeed there is some genetic component. So in our study, the Utah population database doesn't know the genetic makeup of any patients. It just knows what things have happened to them when they've been in the hospital. So that there's this genealogical database, and it's linked to healthcare records. And I can't go in and look at either the healthcare records or the database. It's because there's patient confidentiality issues. So what I can do is access it via Lisa and a computer program. And so in your healthcare record, your doctor says, here are the codes for what this patient had during this hospitalization or during this healthcare event. And everything is coded through something called the ICD-9, although I think now it's the ICD-10. So what we can do is we can say, find people who have the code for surgical site infection or something like surgical site infection. So the computer identifies this group of people, and in this case we found 651 people who had that diagnosis in there or that group of diagnoses for surgical site infection in their healthcare record. And then what you do is you get a group of match controls who are matched by where they're from, sex and age, and you create 1,000 sets of people randomly taken from the database, 651 people who are matched to the 651 people who got surgical site infection, and you look and see if the people who got infection are more closely related to each other based on the information in the Utah population database than the people who didn't. And that's basically the fundamental finding we have, which is people who get surgical site infection are more related to each other than people who don't within that database and the healthcare records. So that doesn't tell us what gene it is or how it happened or anything. It just tells us that this is a good place to go look for a gene, that genes help determine whether you're going to get a wound infection.
And were you surprised by the results and how compelling that they were?
I would say I was more pleased. I have to say this was a belief I'd had for a long time that there must be a genetic component. I think I helped do a review article on the topic of monitoring in the future and got involved, interested in genomics and the contributions of genetics to wound healing around 2003. So this is something I'd been wanting to answer for a long time and didn't know how to do it. And so I wasn't really surprised by the results, but I was very happy because, you know, you do something like this and you think, there are so many variables that could affect this. There's so many things that could confound our result that we might not find anything, even if there is a genetic contribution, because there are so many other contributors to surgical site infection: diabetes, smoking, obesity, the type of surgery they have, how long their surgery lasted, all kinds of things like that. I was worried that that would wash out the genetic effect. But the reality is it's actually a pretty strong marker, and it says, no, this is really real. So I was excited that we got that result because it means we can take another step. I don't think I was that surprised.
How could that change these procedures? And
yeah, so I would say I'm really excited about our findings, but it's a first step, and we have a long way to go. Because right now, I don't know what the genes are. I can imagine what genes they might be. They're genes that relate to how your white cells kill bacteria and how your defenses work against bacteria in your body, but I don't know which ones they are. So our next step, well, first our next step is to get funding, but then the step after that, which we're working on right now, but the step after that is we can actually access the families in the Utah population database. So there's a process for doing that within maintaining privacy and all that sort of thing. And it turns out in Utah, people tend to be pretty happy to come forward and have their blood drawn. And then we can draw their blood and do analysis of their genome in their blood to figure out, and basically you do comparisons of the genomes of a group of people, high risk and low risk, and say, what are the genes that are different between these populations and, you know, that might in some way affect whether they get surgical site infection. So now we'll identify. And my guess would be the families, the genetic contribution isn't from a single gene. It's probably from multiple different genes that so that we'll find that some people have a risk from one reason and some people have a risk from another reason. I think that will be fascinating. I don't know what we'll find. But so the example that we talk a little bit about in the paper, one of the primary ways, and I'm interested in it obviously because it has to do with oxygen, but one of the primary ways that white cells kill the bacteria that and prevent wound infection is by taking oxygen and converting it to oxidants, so things like hydrogen peroxide and bleach, which within the white cell kill the bacteria. And there is already a known genetic disorder called chronic granulomatous disease where the enzyme that converts oxygen into these other oxidants is defective. And patients with that disease get recurrent skin infections as one part of their disease. I'm going to say, I bet there's a mutation of that gene, which is called the FOX gene or the phagosomal oxidase, that makes it work less well, but not so badly that you have overt disease. And those are commonly seen in the world, sort of single gene mutations that make the enzyme just not work as well, but maybe it works okay. So if you find that that's a source of the problem, now you can start thinking about, okay, can we help boost the function of that enzyme? Can we make that enzyme work? What are the kinds of things that we could do that would replace the thing that's not happening in the body that would normally prevent infection? Or potentially we could find a gene that's overproducing something that makes bacteria happy, and then we could figure out how to make that gene stop doing it. So it's all a little pie in the sky right now that there's a lot of steps to take. We've got to figure out what the genes are, and then we've got to figure out what the genes are doing and then how to modify what the gene, you know, or what the defective, the mutated genes are doing, and then how to modify what those mutations do. And then the next step is, okay, if we figure it all out, now when a patient comes to the hospital to have surgery and I want to know if they're at high risk for infection, I actually have to know what their genome is. I have to know what their genetic makeup is. Do they have the normal kind of gene or the abnormal kind of gene? And that's not something that we know currently, although it's on the horizon. So the first human genome, so the genome of a single individual, was sequenced completely, so we know what all their genes are, in 2001, and it cost $100 million. Now you can sequence a human genome, and it took a long time. Now you can sequence a human genome pretty quickly for under $1,000. So I'm going to guess that by the time I can figure out what the genes are, patients are going to come to the hospital knowing their genome, so I'll be able to search their genome and find out if they have reason to believe they're at high risk for infection.
That's incredible. In the press release, this P47 gene mutation was identified, and is that one you might suspect, or
P47 is a piece of that. That's one of the things that goes wrong in these patients with chronic granulomatous disease.
In conclusion, Dr. Herod Hoff advises to look at the history of surgical infections and learn from the past.
The big thing that I'd like to say is, you know, at the time of the Civil War, it was very hard to do surgery because most people would die of infection. And then we figured out things like washing our hands and washing the skin, and then antibiotic prophylaxis came in the 1970s. and really reduced infection rates. And all of it was very focused on reducing contamination that's coming to the skin, and very little of it was focused on the patient's own host defense. And I think one of the reasons that we still have an infection rate around 5% is that we need to focus more on host defenses, and that's really been the area I'm interested in. And I think when we look at the genetics of the person, that's really getting right down to how good are their host defenses, and if we can beef up host defenses, we know that some contamination that happens may become less and less important, and I think that'll be the next big step in reducing surgical site infection. I'm not sure we can ever eliminate it completely, but you know, this idea of being able to boost the immune system of the patient having surgery is likely to be the next big step that we can take to help get rid of surgical site infection after we've done a whole lot of work on preventing contamination.
That was Dr. Harriet Hoff. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Science Questions up next. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah. Before these crowded streets, here stood my dreaming tree.
Below it, he would sit for hours. Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Susie Montgomery.
And I'm Sherry Quinn.
A famous quote by Atticus Finch in the book To Kill a Mockingbird is, "You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it."
Empathy is recognizing, sharing, and even embodying the feelings of someone else. And though we may think little of it, empathy plays a major role in our everyday lives. Our ability or lack of it to empathize can make or break relationships. And to varying degrees, we all use empathy to manipulate others. All of us have feigned empathy, pretending to feel another's pain. Like when someone launches into a full description of their open-heart surgery, or holds you on the phone while they recite the whole saga of their flooded basement while you quote-unquote empathetically listen, cooing, "oh no," and "oh dear," while checking your email.
And all of us, too, have been on the receiving end, having sought empathy with an exaggerated limp or a story of a horrible childhood, which explains your insensitivity to a lover. Those of us who've been through a bad breakup or the loss of a pet can empathize with others going through it. But feeling empathy doesn't command common experience. We can feel empathy for the author who lost her manuscript on a train, or upon sight of tattooed numbers on a Holocaust survivor's arm, having never lived that experience.
Can animals like the chimpanzee who still totes her dead infant on her back 9 days after its death display empathy? Are women more capable of putting themselves in another's shoes? If so, is empathy an evolutionary trait, an empathy gene, so to speak, promoting the traditional guardians of the welfare of offspring? And is it possible to take empathy too far, where your selfless altruistic acts lead you to harm, compromising your health, or even condoning murder?
Today on Science Questions, we talk with Dr. Barbara Oakley, a professor of engineering and the author of a new book released this spring titled Cold-Blooded Kindness, Neuroquirks of a Codependent Killer, or Just Give Me a Shot at Loving You, My Dear.
A scientist focused on the human condition, Oakley writes about caring for others too much, exploring whether some people might be pathologically altruistic. That is, predisposed to kindness and empathy to the point of being destructive to themselves and others, such as animal hoarders, the quintessential neighbor woman with 37 cats, parents whose lives are consumed trying to save their child who won't get a job, seniors who give away their entire life savings to do God's work, or friends who enable an alcoholic's benders.
In Carol Alden's case, she was a master at seducing us into thinking that we were helping her.
That was Barbara Oakley speaking about Carol Alden, the subject of her new book. Oakley's work grows from a varied background. She went from being a private in the U.S. military to army captain, and at the height of the Cold War, she worked as a Russian translator on Soviet trawlers in the Bering Sea.
I remember one night, we were all having an unusual party, and there was a big picture of Stalin up on the wall, and I couldn't take it anymore. One night, I finally said, Yuri Vasilyevich, why do you have that picture of Stalin on your wall? Don't you realize he's killed something on the order of 20, 30 million Russians? And he answered, Barbara, everybody makes mistakes. When the whole world is Soviet, we will not have these kinds of mistakes. So I believe that helped underpin these ideas of altruism can be pathological. We often do things, even politically, certainly in politics, in religion, in academia, certainly in business, all sorts of areas. Anywhere you have a social enterprise, you can have this all this horrific kind of behavior all hidden under the idea of we're just helping.
Sometimes do-gooders do more harm than good, and the dark side of altruism has been the subject of Oakley's last two books, one titled Evil Genes, Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Felled, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend.
And the other book, Pathological Altruism, about which ecologist E.O. Wilson wrote, was one of the few books in evolutionary biology that taught him something completely new and demonstrates how medicine, biology, and evolutionary theory can be brought together to illuminate an important part of the human condition.
We tend to think, well, there's got to be this uniform sense of most people want to do things to help others. But if you look at it from an evolutionary perspective, people are so complex that they are, in some sense, their own ecosystem. And there are niches for predators as well as prey.
Preying on someone's empathy or acting selflessly to the extreme are known scientifically as pathological altruism, defined as socially well-meaning but harmful and excessive forms of self-sacrifice that become more and more problematic over time. Oakley insists society should not shy away from taking a close look at the ill effects of certain deeds couched in altruism, because no one dares challenge or offend the well-meaning foreign aid person, for instance, hell-bent on good, when in reality their Western ideology may do more harm than good. Oakley insists, too, that more research needs to be done to determine the potential biological basis in those that display behavior of pathological altruism.
She has started this research and draws on experts across disciplines to explore this radical altruism, looking at the altruistic nature of suicide martyrs, workaholics, or people who maintain relationships with physical and sexual abusers, bringing to light the potential harm of altruistic acts, and examining the physical science behind it.
Her latest book is what she calls a true crime narrative about Carol Alden, a Utah artist and mother of five who shot her husband to death in Millard County, Utah, in July of 2006. This murder mystery differs from others because it weaves in neuroscience, taking the reader literally deeper into the mind and pathology of the killer.
So there's all these interesting little undercurrents in that particular case. But how does this relate to neuroscience? What I found was people like Carol Alden, and there are many people who have some of these same subtle traits. I'm not saying everybody, maybe 5%, 10%, mm-hmm. but there are people who will use your best traits, your sense of empathy and caring for others, to get you to do things that you normally shouldn't or wouldn't want to do.
According to Oakley, Carol Alden was a master at just that. And by insisting that she was a victim, a battered wife at the mercy of her vitriolic husband, who ruthlessly beat her and drove her to murder, she gained massive support, and in fact was never convicted of murder, but rather manslaughter, and has been serving her 1 to 15 year sentence in a Utah state prison since 2007. where she continues her recognized 3D artwork. A self-taught welder, she once created a colorful 90-foot dragon out of steel that lurked in the Salt Lake Library's reflective pool during the 2006 Utah Arts Festival that summer.
One piece she did in a prison is a self-image made out of felt, thread, pencils, and a sewing needle. It depicts herself skewered horizontally to the bars of a prison cell, watching her children disappear into the distance. And she managed to endear herself to her fellow inmates during one winter, when she sculpted a 70-foot dragon out of snow in the prison yard. Her fellow inmates sacrificed their juice drinks to art, pouring them like paint over the dragon. Kara also created a snow sea monster one year, with prison uniforms stuffed in its mouth. The guards failed to see the humor in this, but the inmates certainly did. Alden had this ability to win people over, and once they were in her court, according to Oakley, she preyed on their altruism by playing both saint and victim in order to get what she wanted. Oakley's book illustrates Alden's pathology, her patterns of harmful giving and taking, with a story about Alden blatantly lying to the press about her teenage daughter dying of breast cancer, all for an exotic bird.
All of this was completely untrue, but reporters fell for it lock, stock, and barrel. And she said, "My daughter's dying wish is to get an emu chick." So next thing you know, there's dozens of reporters lined up at the airport taking pictures as Carol Alden and her daughter received this very expensive emu chick that Carol herself had always wanted. And they're taking pictures. She gets this free emu chick just out of the kindness of strangers who fall for her.
Oakley's book depicts Alden doting on people in bad situations, developing multiple intense relationships of codependency. An example being the relationship with her husband, Martin Sessions, who was a drug addict and whom Carol took under her wing,
then shot him first in the back, confirmed by the autopsy, and after carefully propping a pillow against his head, shot him at close range in the head. Alden still has a slew of supporters who contest this evidence and believe she shot her husband as a last resort, in self-defense as he was attacking her. Oakley accuses Alden of playing on her empathy with her battered woman defense and says this defenseless do-gooder is taking us for a ride.
Well, the real story is, of course, much more complex. She had other motives altogether. And in fact, she was pinning this poor man she was stating publicly that he was a monster, and that wasn't true at all. In fact, she herself was well known, if you were in those circles, as the sadomasochism queen of Salt Lake City.
As we delve deeper into the book, we discover Alden had not been abused, was having an affair, and planned her husband's murder over a long period of time.
There's an outstanding psychologist who's really, he's normally very, very good, and he sees through people like this. But Carol Alden was so good, she fooled him. He came back saying, well, gee, you know, basically coming up with substantiating the idea she was a perfectly normal individual who'd just gotten trapped in this and she was going to defend herself. But yet, there's now evidence that Marty's not the only guy she killed, that there's other previous boyfriends who died under suspicious and mysterious circumstances.
Oh, my.
It's perfectly possible that she may be a serial killer. In my opinion, you can look at the records, and there's just so much suspicious going on. But yet psychologists couldn't catch it. She's so good at playing on us.
Barbara Oakley makes us question whether empathy, intensely feeling another's emotions, can lead us into dangerous waters. Does really empathizing involve risking losing our ability to discern between good and bad? Can empathy be so sweet that it shades the truth? It is interesting to think of war, perhaps a kind of patriotic empathy that can lead good, well-meaning people to commit heinous acts of killing while still feeling they are doing the right thing.
Once a mentality like this sets in, it is really hard to reverse, maybe because the brain is altered. For soldiers, there is evidence that PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, looks like any other brain injury, where the connective tissue is compromised. And neuroimaging has shown that psychopaths, infamous for lacking empathy altogether, have very different brains, whose limbic systems, known as the emotional circuit, does not light up in morally objectionable situations. Oakley suggests extreme empathy is no different.
It was surprising to find this tall, slender engineer from Michigan studying the pathology of kindness through a Utah artist convicted of manslaughter, housed in a prison in Draper.
I do my engineering work by day, and then by night, especially Friday night, when the National Enquirer comes out, I read the National Enquirer. I just love it. And the Globe, too. And the Globe is fantastic. And I say that, too, because there's an article coming out in Globe about cold-blooded kindness. But there's also an article coming out in Nature, which is the top scientific journal in the world. Articles about the book are going to span the gamut from gutter to pinnacle. At any rate, I think that what I wanted to do was to write something that was related to true crime, a regular true crime, but show something deeper, that there's actually science behind what's going on, that we can understand in a very simple and straightforward sense why people do the kinds of things they do and be informed by science about this. And that's what I was trying to do.
Perhaps it was her mother's condition when Oakley was young that set the ball rolling.
My mother was a good mother. She had an aneurysm when I was about 12, and she lost her memory completely. So she didn't know we were her kids or that she was married. And I think now that I look back on it, that probably had an impact in my thinking that sometimes actual wiring can make a difference in how we act.
That early impression manifested when Oakley started studying the brain. It was unlikely she would even pursue the sciences. She, in fact, hated science and math as a child, and in her early 20s, decided she wanted to become a professor of linguistics. So she enlisted in the army to study Russian. She went on to become a captain stationed in Germany and was in charge of communications equipment, where she saw the exciting potential of a career in science and technology, and pursued her PhD in engineering. An algebra class was the turning point.
Oh, there was no stopping me. I fell in love with mathematics. I fell in love with science. And so I ended up going all the way on. Well, I would study engineering for a while because I was interested. I could see the potential of technology, and electrical engineering was fascinating because it's mathematics made real. You can work with circuitry and really use the math, and I loved that. But I could only take about 6 months of it at a time. So I would study my engineering, I would be really careful with it, and then I'd go out and work on Soviet trawlers as a translator up on the Bering Sea for 6 months at a time and drink all the time and have a great time. And then I'd come back and I'd be this solid, very careful engineering student, and then I'd go back out at sea. And then I happened to go down to Antarctica because I had good radio experience. And while I was down there, I met this wonderful man, and we fell in love, and we knew each other for 3 weeks, and 3 weeks after that, he proposed, and we were married. And so I always say I had to go to the ends of the earth to meet that man. But that's how I fell in love with science. And then, as I began working in the discipline, I'm always interested in people. So I still kept reflecting on that, and also reflecting on the idea that I'd worked in so many different jobs, from Russian translator to military enlisted and officer to South Pole radio station manager. And all of these kinds of things give a background to understanding how people see things, how they work. And I wanted to use my science to help reflect on that and understand that. I began wondering, why do bad people do the kinds of things they do? And that was actually because of my sister. And so that's how my first book, which is the somewhat tongue-in-cheek titled Evil Genes, Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Failed, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend. And she really did steal my mother's boyfriend. So I decided to use my scientific background to avoid conventional psychological approaches, but rather to see what science itself was telling us about why people do what they do.
And why do people think this is controversial? I mean, what are people scared about finding out, do you think?
They are afraid that if you say or think that someone does what they do because of their neurobiological underpinnings, that you are pinning them down to something that's deterministic and saying, well, then they can't change. Because if they're genetically programmed to do something, then you're in some sense putting them in a box where they can't shift out of it. And of course, that's not true at all.
Oakley says people tend to find social explanations for strange or malevolent behaviors and have a history of leaning exclusively on psychology to explain disorders such as eating abnormalities or autism.
In the 50s and 60s, everybody knew it was cold parenting that had made these children autistic. Can you imagine you have the difficult problem of handling a child with a severe difficulties, and you're also being blamed for that when it's not true at all? That's what these kinds of purely social approaches can lead to. So the bottom line is you have to have a balanced approach. You have to acknowledge that, yes, sometimes we do have neurobiophysiological underpinnings to these kinds of things, and sometimes it's social, and they interact with one another.
The study of autism and other disorders has come a long way since the 60s, from thinking they were social ills to discovering many of them are genetic or have some other biological basis. Oakley writes books about how extreme altruism can too have a biological root, and she says the research needs to catch up.
Actually, the field of epigenetics, combined with environment and experiences of past generations, are proving to play a significant role in sculpting our biology and behavior.
In her effort to understand the science behind pathological altruism, she approached researchers in the field for academic input. But they were reluctant to focus on the bad side of it.
I would try to get specialists in altruism to contribute a chapter, and they couldn't. They would send me something and would just be on the good side of altruism. It was as if the sun could never set on their happy world of helping. They couldn't even grapple with the idea of altruism having a negative side.
Even Oakley grew tired of studying evil.
After I wrote Evil Genes, I thought, oh gosh, I'm really sick and tired of writing about nasty people. I would like to write about somebody good for a change. And then I was also reflecting on the idea that many people had told me that we can buy that maybe Hitler had a screw loose. He had something biophysiologically wrong up there. But all Germans didn't have this. Certainly not. But they followed him. What was going on there? And as I began to think about it, I began to realize it wasn't the bad traits. It was good traits. It's good traits that could, and in fact, Hitler himself said something like, once I appeal to their highest motives, their highest nature, that's when I've got them. And so that's what started me with, I want to start looking at pathologies of altruism. So I worked on the two books simultaneously. I worked on the book about Carol Alden, and that was to give a solid framework in a concrete sense for how someone could use our best traits against us. Of course, at the beginning of writing the book, I thought that she was truly a good person who had just been sucked into this world and was trying to help others. But I realized as the book went on and my research went on that no, I was the one who had been seduced and tricked. And in fact, we are often the ones who are seduced and tricked into these kinds of things. But at the same time, I did an edited volume for Oxford University Press, and I got many of the top neuroscientists and researchers in the world to contribute to this book to give insight into how altruism could go awry. It can contribute to depression, as with my student who became very depressed because she was being empathetic and tried to help her brother. And of course, she wasn't helping him at all. But it also can lead. Did you know that if you treat the selflessness of anorexia, that that can be as beneficial as directly addressing the issues with food themselves? Of course, there's suicide bombing, genocide. People don't get up and say, I'm going to go kill those horrible Tutsis because I'm just a terrible, evil person myself. They think, Tutsis are just cockroaches. I'm helping my fellow Hutu if I'm helping. It's the altruism that lies as much behind genocide as any evil act. So I'm not saying, I'm very pro-altruism. I'm very pro-empathy. I'm just pragmatic. You have to realize how that can have a flip side that can be very, very dangerous.
Would you go so far to say that altruism is a religion?
Yes, I would. In fact, I think that's a very good question. I myself think of it as today's secular religion. When you think about these kinds of things, genocide, depression, anorexia, suicide bombing, all of these kinds of issues can rise out of altruism. It's important to be aware of how you can be manipulated, you can be played.
Oakley usually writes two books at once. Her approach is to study the science behind the motivation for crime in the first book, and then in the second, to tell the murder mystery laced with science.
To me, it's fascinating to research the written record, the record of talking to people, and really do it right, and then to juxtapose that knowledge with the scientific body of knowledge, which I think it's never been done, really, that I can find in true crime sort of writing. And there's a way to do that in a very readable, It's riveting. It's just riveting information, and it helps you put into perspective these important ideas like, yes, there are people like Carol Alden out there who will use your best traits against you.
Oakley is drawn towards writing about the dark side of human nature. Her next books will focus on the neurological aspects of pathological self-love and an extreme case of murder and narcissism in Utah.
When I started looking at my next book, I'm going to do a pair of books again, just as I did last time. I'll do an edited book on the neuroscience of narcissism, and I'll do a popular book. And this will be on the Pinder case, which happened here in Utah some 12 years ago or so. And there's a very interesting, self-centered, narcissistic. If you look at his actions, what you can see is that he felt perfectly justified in shooting his two ranch hands and then blowing up their bodies. And so that's, I think, a perfect case to start showcasing some of the neuroscience behind narcissism. So that's what I'm working on now, and I couldn't be happier because I get to meet more of Utah's wonderful people.
In her writings about the devious side of the human mind, engineer and author Barbara Oakley is inciting areas of neurological research that are ripe for investigation. And the sooner the better, because science is at the heart of her genre of crime novels.
Scientists are not studying the idea of people who can be empathetic and actually think they're helping someone when actually they're just making themselves feel better, as with the woman who would go down and buy her daughter heroin because that way she could be sure that she was getting clean heroin. I mean, these kinds of codependent behavior patterns, that's killing with kindness.
Thank you for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.